Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
I have kids come up to me, "Chef, I got a great idea for a dish." I'm like, you know what? Screw you. All right. Listen, you cannot get out the pasta, you know, at 8 o'clock and you're worried about telling me a dish. Worry about making sure I don't have to think about you during service. Then we'll discuss dishes.
Today, it is my pleasure to have Bill Telepan, a terrific cook whose food I have been eating for more than 25 years. That's a long time, Bill. After apprenticing for the great French chef Alain Chappelle and working stateside for Alfred Portale at the seminal new American restaurant Gotham Bar and Grill, Bill ran kitchens in New York for more than 10 years before opening his eponymous restaurant in 2005. In 2016, 2 years after he earned a Michelin star, Bill suddenly shut Telepan. We were all devastated, those of us who lived in the neighborhood. He is now the executive chef at Oceana in New York's Midtown, where I had perhaps my favorite meal of 2016. Bill is also the executive chef of Wellness in the Schools, an organization dedicated to making school food healthy. Here to talk about the future of mid-price chef-driven restaurants, the state of school lunches, and perhaps most importantly, our shared love of patty melts.
Yes.
Is Bill Telepan. We do love patty melts.
Oh, my goodness. We do love them very much.
And that's that. I think that's what I miss most about Telepan. You have to put the patty melt on the menu at Oceana.
You know, I was thinking about it the other day because I saw something about patty melts and I was like, gosh, I could go for one right now. And I was like, how can I put this into this menu? So I'll think about it. I'm working in it because we do have a good grass-fed burger. Remember, we had a little grass-fed competition.
Yeah. Yes, we did.
You and Nick and I at Telepan.
Yes, we had Bill make a burger with grass-fed meat that he was using versus corn-fed and was it dry-aged? I can't even remember, but it was maybe just corn-fed, and we had a taste test.
Yes, and we found out that you could definitely taste the difference when it's just a plain patty. But then when we added the bacon and cheddar onto it,
it didn't matter.
It didn't matter. And the thing about grass-fed, as I always say, it's really the only burger or kind of meat I can eat these days. It's weird because I've been eating it for so long now that my body doesn't know what to do with the other stuff. So when I do have the other stuff, it's like, I'll be right back.
That's awesome. First of all, tell us about life at the Telepan family table growing up.
Oh my gosh, it was kind of frenetic because my dad, who worked at General Motors on the line for 30 years,
wow,
in various different factories.
Where is this?
So we grew up in Sayreville, New Jersey,
okay,
which is central Jersey, sort of like right around where the Shore Parkway starts going into the Shore, and so he worked different shifts all the time, sometimes two jobs, sometimes even weekends on a third job. And mom was so we sort of the meals went around him, except for Sunday was always 3 o'clock. It was, you know, we sat down for dinner, whether it was at our house or we spent a lot of time at my grandparents' house, my mom's parents' house when they were around or an aunt and uncle. But mostly it was definitely we had that 3 o'clock meal. And, you know, it's not like these days where, you know, the kids get their own meals or whatever. We were put down what was put in front of us. I'm half Hungarian, half Slovak, so it reflected a lot of that food, stuffed cabbage, chicken paprikash.
Hungarian goulash.
Hungarian goulash. A lot of meat and potato. Dad wasn't a fish guy. So the only
how ironic that you're cooking at Oceana.
It's crazy how it sort of ended up this way. But the only fish we ate was during Lent, and it was breaded flounder, and it was a very small amount.
Nothing wrong with breaded flounder.
I do like breaded flounder too. I like things breaded. So, it was kind of sporadic and crazy. Mom was working, cleaning banks or whatnot, and making ends meet, You know, it was a good time. We got fed well with what we had, and I ate everything as a kid. My brother, the oldest of the family, was the one who didn't have a vegetable until he went into the Air Force, and But, you know, Brussels sprouts, you know, lima beans.
No.
You know, I ate everything. No.
Oh,
yeah. I ate every pickled beets. You know,
really?
I put it down.
You couldn't say no.
I couldn't say no. So I was a hungry kid.
That's funny. So it sounds like you grew up in very much a working class household in New Jersey. Your dad's working the line. Your mom's working too. To augment the family income. But it also sounds like food was pretty important.
Well, you know, I think, you know, I think because my dad had to be fed.
I see.
You know? And so, because he worked really hard. So it was important in its way. Like we did take in pride in like whose meal tasted better, whether what holiday it was, you know?
Got it.
And so it was like, if you go to a christening, it was like, the conversation would start. It'd be like, "How was the christening?" Well, the food was good, you know. So that's how parties were judged, you know.
And that's the way they should be judged.
Exactly,
frankly.
I think so too. So it was kind of interesting in that fact. But it wasn't like I never ate at a gourmet restaurant until my sister graduated from college, and we ate at the Fromagerie in Rumson, New Jersey. We went there, and it was very weird because it was
very upscale
for New Jersey. And I was during the time I was going to CIA. So I had worked in restaurants in CIA, but they were kind of like glorified TGI Fridays type places, you know, where they had silly names for the burgers. But then we would make like, you know, this. What I would do is, it was interesting because I bought like the Paul Bocuse book, and we would go through the book and do like flounder à la Monnier or whatever, and do like these dishes that were on there. So it'd be like, you know, Cracker Jack cheeseburgers, and they'd be like, flounder à la Antoine. And then you'd have to sit there and explain what à la Antoine is. Nobody ordered it anyway. So they want the Cracker Jack cheesesteak or whatever the hell it was. So.
That's really funny. So when did you decide to become a chef, and how did that come about?
Well, I had cooked since I was 15 years old at a deli, and then played baseball, so quit that job in high school, and then when I went back to the summer ended, I started dishwashing at a local restaurant, and then they needed a part-time cook, so I said, well, I used to cook at this deli, so they gave me the job, and so I did dishes and cook, and then eventually, I got a part-time role with my senior year at school, and then I worked at another job which had a CIA graduate as a chef, and it was there that I was kind of having a really great time with it, but knew it had to end because I had to go to college, and I was going to start at the community college because my grades were good but not great, but I wanted to be an engineer, and because I was really good at math, and decided that I would go to the community school, get my grades up, and then start applying after a couple years into a regular engineering school, blah blah blah. But that lasted about 2 months. I hated school. I was working at UPS as a truck washer, which was fun and all good money, but I really missed the kitchen. And I was still living at home, so I would drive home from school and UPS, and it would go by the restaurant. So I'd stop in once in a while, and I would complain or blah, 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 you know what I mean? And they're like, well, why don't you come work here? We'll get you into the CIA, because they had just sort of – there was another – so the chef became the GM, and then he brought in this other guy who was a CIA grad. And so I was like – went back and forth, and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to do it. So I went home to my mom, and I said, you know what? I'm going to quit college today. I'm going to go back to Garfunkel's. That was the name of the restaurant I'm going to go with Ace and Dave, and they're going to set me up at the CIA. She goes, you're a jerk. You're not going to do that.
Now, the CIA, I said, of course, is the Culinary Institute of America.
I'm like, Ma, no, I really like this. I think this is what I should be doing. I miss it. And so I did.
And she just thought you were hurtling backward in time.
Totally. I mean, she just thought I was not going to amount to anything. And I understand that. It wasn't like, you know, I was showing progress. You know what I mean? I did well in school. I stayed out of trouble.
That wasn't the American arc.
Right. And to be a chef in my world where I grew up, it was like, what? What does that
mean?
Right.
You're flipping burgers at McDonald's.
Exactly. It wasn't like, you know, I was going to be Andre Sultan or anything
like
that.
Right.
So I went to school from there, and that's when I decided, like, I was going to be a chef
right
at that moment.
And where are you? Because, you know, chefs all over America are divided into people who think culinary school is valuable and necessary versus I just want to hire a young, hungry person who will do whatever it takes to learn how to cook?
Well, let me tell you, though, I'm on both sides, because you think of a lot of the immigrants that come through your kitchen, and a lot of them who are terrific cooks, and some of them who become terrific chefs, right? They're out there, right? So that's a way you can do that. It takes a little time. You don't spend money. But a guy like me who grew up in New Jersey, was working at really crappy restaurants at the time, and who had this, I think, you know, I needed to be exposed to an incredible array of different cuisines and ideas. And I never would have gotten that in the restaurants I was working at in New Jersey. So the CIA was perfect for me. So I'm of both schools. You know, the thing is, yes, culinary schools are a lot of money. And do you need, if you're, like, if I had been exposed to a world and our family had eaten out at different restaurants and traveled the world, like my daughter, I mean, my, you know, the places she has eaten in right. around the world, you
and
know,
your daughter's
as far as Argentina.
As a teenager,
you know,
right?
As a teenager, right? And it's like, you know, the things she has eaten, if I had eaten those, I might have said, you know what? I don't need to go to culinary school. I know I need to go work at X, Y, and Z place to further my career.
So it really all depends on your background.
The individual, yes, of course. I believe that. So there's a lot of kids who are like, say, in the South Bronx who are, you know, want to be chefs or think they want to be chefs because what they see on television or whatever, they should go. I think if they can get scholarships and afford to go to school, they should go to school. I mean, but who's going to tell them, oh, you should go work at Oceana or La Bernardine because right. they don't know about these places.
Exactly. It's
you know?
Outside their
It's outside their world.
Yep.
And so, yeah, I mean, it depends.
So you apprenticed. I mean, you spent some time working for Alain Chappelle in France
right.
and then working for Alfred Portale for a long time.
Yeah.
Do you still think that that arc is the best way to become a chef? And do you think that people have the patience to do that now?
It's a hard thing to say. I just know what I know. And I just felt like the way my career went the entire time, it was always a fork in the road came up. You know, whether it was like when I actually graduated CIA, I interviewed with Charlie Palmer, who was then at the River Cafe, and he didn't have a job available.
Seminole American chef.
I was introduced to him by a chef at the CIA. And either he didn't have a job or I was a terrible trail at the time. But
trailing is when you follow somebody trying to learn what their job.
Exactly. And so I had taken this job at the Seaport, making a pretty good chunk of change. It was a terrible job. Like, I should not. I had a good time. It was fun. But then I get a call from Alfred Portale at the time, who said, I need a cook. Can you come visit me? So I went to go see him. The truth is, I never heard of Gotham Bar and Grill at the time because, you know, no one. I mean, people were talking about it. It was 3 years old. It was one of the hottest restaurants in New York. But I just didn't know. You
sure.
know, I just didn't know.
Because it wasn't part of your world.
Right. And so I went to interview with him, and he goes, one of the questions, he goes, so you've heard of us, right? And I said, yeah. And so,
of course,
you lie, and you take the job, and I took the job, and it was $100 less a week. I remember this, and I remember going.
And that's $100 less than not a lot of money,
right? Exactly. So, so it wasn't 5% of my pay; it was like 30% of my pay. And so, I ended up taking it, and ended up loving it, and being in that sort of environment, and being exposed to that world of not only at that time was. It like a high profile place and it was hot and we had the world figures, stars coming into this place. It was insane. But the line was just this, you know, at the time was mostly American guys who were hungry and driven. And, you know, this predates Tom Colicchio and Tom Valenti. But there was these guys like Bruce Beatty and this guy Lincoln, what was his last name? Engstrom and Mark Spangenthal and Tom Carlin. And when Jacinto Guadarrama, who's now been Alfred's chef de cuisine for many, many years, was starting off, just these hungry guys. And it was really like energizing for a guy like me. And then, you know, learning that Alfred went to France and Charlie Palmer went to France and Bruce Beatty, who had gone to France, I was like, I guess I should go to France. You know, it just all these things just made sense to me. And so that's when I decided to go to France and do those things and then get back. And then I worked at La Bernardine because my friend Bruce was there. Then did my year that you're supposed to do a year, you think? And then I went to work with Danielle.
Wow.
Ballou at Le Cirque. And then Alfred called me back to come and be the sous chef to replace John Shank, who had been his longtime executive sous chef there. And then I was with Alfred for 4 years. So all these things, you never know what's going to happen. So like that path I took was not one that says, in 5 years, I got to be a chef and this is how I'm going to do it. It never is that way, I don't think. I think you work and you sort of listen, you learn. You know, I applied for chef's jobs, didn't get them at the time. But you just sort of, so kids these days, I don't know what they're, I mean, listen, there's a lot with television and what's going on with TV and you see these people and Top Chef and Chopped and all this stuff going on. Everybody's a chef and you know, I walked by to the post office. There's a place called Mexi-Kosher and I guess the guy who's the chef at Mexi-Kosher was on Top Chef because there's a big poster of him on Top Chef. And I'm like, oh, so that's, you know. Jim Parris, the longtime editor at Food Art, said to me one day, he goes, I'm just sick and tired of getting these pitches from people who said so-and-so was a contestant on so-and-so's show, season 3, and, you know, he didn't win, but he was on it.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, there's different paths now. I don't think that you follow that path.
It's the equivalent to the actors who say they spend 2 years on General Hospital.
Right.
And it is a way of developing a craft. And in the actor's case, it truly is.
Right.
Whereas it's not clear to me that being a contestant on Top Chef or Chopped is really a way to learn your craft.
No, just cooking alone is hard enough to learn and get up to speed. I mean, it always takes. Even like I just brought in a guy to Oceana who was with me at Telepan for several years, who's one of the most brilliant cooks I've ever worked with. Threw him on this station. It wasn't like I could say, here, you do this job and you're good. It took him 3 or 4 days to learn it and find the ninth pans and the sheet pans. And then it's going to take him 3 weeks till it's like I can be like it can be blind. You know, you can just look at him and he knows exactly what you're talking about. So it takes time for even somebody who has this experience. So imagine a kid coming from culinary school who doesn't have any real restaurant experience being thrown into it. It's like I don't know what they're thinking. They have to do it and do it over and over again. They have to chop the onion. Like after a certain time, I could close my eyes and chop an onion.
Right.
You know what I mean? Without cutting my finger.
Right. Know? Tom Valenti once did that for me. He chopped herbs with his eyes closed.
I can look at a sauce and say it's ready, or I could smell something and I know it's done, or you could just, you know, you could be walking around in the kitchen and things are you hear noises, you smell smells, you see things going on, you know exactly what's going on, and you could just tell when things are. But that
takes time.
That wasn't 30 years ago for me. That was, you know, over time you sort of developed that. And then couple that with managing, all right? So I always like to tell the cooks at my restaurants, like, if you cannot manage your station, you don't know what's inventory, you don't know how, you don't know how to produce it and make it work well. And how are you going to manage a restaurant, a kitchen, not just a restaurant, but a kitchen? Like, you've got several stations you have people you have to do, each with different personalities. It's like you have the pasta station, you have the fish station, you have the meat station. They all have different personalities, just like people do. You need to manage those well in order to think about being a chef. I have kids come up to me, chef, I got a great idea for a dish. I'm like, you know what? Screw you. All right?
That's not very supportive, Bill.
I don't mean it that way, but it's like you should be – the idea is that, yes, this is a great thing. I'm glad you have an idea. But listen, you cannot get out the pasta, you know, at 8 o'clock and you're worried about telling me a dish. You're coming in. Worry about making sure I don't have to think about you during service. Then we'll discuss dishes. I'm very supportive in way of hearing ideas. But you get the point what I'm saying, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Like, learn to cook. And then, like, you know, my mother has great ideas, right? You know, she's always calling me, I got this great idea for you. And I'm like, Ma, what is it?
That's awesome. So talking about management, it's a perfect segue to opening your own restaurant, and you opened your own restaurant in 2005, the beloved and now short lamented, because just closed,
yes,
Telepan. Tell me what that was like. You know, you decided to open up close to where you lived. What was the idea, and then what was the experience like?
Well, first of all, I mean, I wasn't looking to do it up on the Upper West Side. I mean, I was just looking to do it somewhere that I thought made sense. And so my partner, Jimmy Nicholas, and I, Jimmy lived in Tribeca. So, you know, he was the money, and I was thinking, like, I want to be near where he lives, you know, because he's the money. I don't want to be like, oh, let's open near my house and then you have to travel all this way. But then I got a call from a friend of mine who said, you know, I know you're looking for a spot. You should get in touch with this realtor who's really great. And just, you know, there was an article recently about her that this woman written and said like, oh, she finds places for people. And I was like, all right. So I cold called her and I said, I'm Bill Talapan. She knew who I was. And I just ended my run at Judson Grill for 7 years. So she said, I think I have a spot. Do you want me to show you? And it turned out to be Santa Fe, which is on West 69th Street, which has been there for 20 plus years. Sort of a neighborhood joint that, you know, Tex-Mex food, great margaritas. I had never eaten there, believe it or not, and all the time. I was living on the Upper West Side since 91, and this is about 2004. And never ate there, but would drive by and I always look at the awning and say, hey, that looks like a good spot for a restaurant. And I walked in and it just sort of grabbed me. And I did it myself. I went for the tour myself without Jimmy. And I called Jimmy up that day and I said, I think I found a great spot. And he's like, where? And I said, Santa Fe. He goes, I love that place. Because he had lived on the Upper West Side for years, went there a lot. He said, let's go look at it together again. And so we did. And we were just like instantly, it just wasn't even like, I had been through, you know, looked at a lot of spots and it was kind of like, this was wrong with it, this was wrong with it. But there was nothing wrong with this spot. Everything went well. Like, it was sort of like, we wanted this price. They agreed. Then it became like, all right, let's really nail this contract down, which then took a long time because our lawyers are in
the— they always do.
The landlord was based in Maryland and their lawyers were in Denver and it was ski season and I'm still trying to raise money. So there was a little panic happening and I had told you before I was interviewing at some jobs and wondering whether I should take them and drop this. But, you know, we were more than halfway with the money and, you know, it was hard. I mean, asking people for money, cold, you know, just saying, hey, you want to give me a couple hundred
thousand
dollars?
Tell me about it. Tell me about it, bro.
To open a restaurant and, you know, and it wasn't like I was going to open one for 400 grand. This space needed a lot of TLC. I was moving the kitchen from one side to the other. I needed equipment and, you know, we hired Larry Bogdan now. We wanted to make a big splash.
Who was a great restaurant
great
architect.
Great restaurant architect. And you know, we were thinking, you know, so I don't know. And then it just sort of the contractor was a pain in the neck and all the shit you hear about, whether it's liquor license. And, you know, the thing about it is the thing I love about cooking and working in the restaurant business is that it in a 24-hour period, it happens. You know, you receive your food, you create it, you manufacture it, you sell it, people consume it, and then you're done at the end of the day. And there's a final. At the end of the day, you know it's done. Nothing continues.
And then the next
so if you had
day,
a shitty day,
again.
The next day you could have a great day, right? Whereas like when you're constructing or putting a restaurant, like waiting for people to hear back from people who are like on an island somewhere and you're like thinking like, I need to know if you're going to give me that money, you know? Like a struggle. That whole tension, there's a different tension that—
And a completely different rhythm to
Right, and you're not used to it as a chef. And so it wasn't that it was hard to do. It was just that you had to be patient and you had to deal with— You know, imagine going to the Department of Buildings and trying to say, can you just put a check mark here so I can move on?
But you did open—
It did
you
open, fine. Actually, we're 3 months late, like everybody else,
right.
And we slid in 2005 and opened up on December 16, 2005. And, you know, at the time, you know, it was Cafe Luxembourg and West up there.
In
my neighborhood and a couple restaurants near Lincoln Center, but, you know, that had been around a while. Lincoln wasn't there yet. The Danielle Corner wasn't there yet. John Frazier wasn't with Dovetail yet.
So the idea was that it would be a neighborhood restaurant.
That was close to Lincoln. I used to say a neighborhood destination restaurant because you
right.
had Lincoln Center and we wanted to fill it up pre-theater. You had a neighborhood which was, you know, fairly affluent, very, you know, and you know, there was this idea that the Upper West Side was cheap, right? And like they could not afford a restaurant. But I had Ansonia up on the Upper West Side, and that had many problems. Inside, we had many issues. But on the one hand, it was well reviewed by Ruth Reichel. We had a great review, and we started funneling people into that place, people were spending money, but the idea was that there was during the cigar smoking craze, and
Ansoni was this restaurant on the Upper West Side. It was weird. It was on two levels.
Yeah, and it was in a great room or whatever. But but the Upper West Side, and you know, we had the East Side, which people could go home and just take a cab or walk across the park, I felt like Ansoni was above 72nd Street. I felt like 72nd Street was the threshold because you were able to capture Lincoln Center, which what Ansoni wasn't able to do was between 5 and 7 do any business because
right.
there was nobody there. But so we were able to fill that in the beginning and then be busy for
right.
the rest of the
night. So and then you built it up so that it was a neighborhood destination restaurant.
Yes.
And you were very well reviewed in the Times. You got although chefs are never happy with their reviews, but I can tell you as someone who read that review, is like, oh, I'm glad Bill got a good review. You get a Michelin star, and then the world is shocked, the world of food people. Not just in New York, but all over, because you have a national reputation, when you decided to close the restaurant. And you were very open about the conditions or the factors that went into your decision. So talk a little bit about that and what it means for restaurants in general, not just in New York, but in many other cities.
Yeah, I mean, well, the thing is, it's kind of a catch-22, right? So, you know, I had Telepan for 8 years and decided to open Telepan Local. But the thing, you know, that was criticized was like, why is this uptown?
And Local was in Tribeca.
Right. Going downtown. He's too old to be hip and blah, blah, blah. And he shouldn't, you know, he should stay up on the Upper West Side. It's like we have to grow. Like when David Chang was reviewed for Nishi and a lot of it was about, you know, his need to expand. Right. And that we have to these days, you know, we can't just have a singular restaurant by ourselves. You need to build an infrastructure. You have to lower cost and your overhead of running. So
there are economies of scale.
Right, exactly. So I was the executive chef and was getting paid like the executive chef. And I had a general manager who was getting paid a pretty decent amount for a general manager. We had two managers. I had a couple sous chefs and a pastry chef and who everyone loved. And like, you know, the thing is, after a certain point, when we opened Local, the idea was that, all right, I could go and make a little more money and pay everyone else a little more money and move people up in Telepan and pay them a little more money. And this way I have
an organization.
An organization where, you know, there's a few of us who are really, you know, just making a little more money than we were and allowing other people to grow and make more money.
Right.
And you keep them. I mean, the worst part is, like, finding a cook is hard enough. Could you imagine trying to find a good sous chef when you don't have one in your kitchen? Or you want to keep people and you want other cooks to see that, hey, Telepan is, he allows us to grow in here. So I should stay here. I could do something here. And it's not the case anymore. And I saw, you know, I had a conversation with Anita Lowe around the time I closed.
And I had a
great chef at Anissa. And and we had a conversation. And I kind of knew she was in the same situation where we have this. It wasn't rent. I mean, rent was high and all, but it was manageable. If I had made, you know, a couple $100,000 more a year, I might have been fine. We might not be having this conversation. But you know, it's a matter of that.
And Anissa is still open?
No, it's still open until May.
She's going to close it.
But
okay.
It's the same thing. It's like taxes are up. The minimum wage keeps going up, which is fine. And I'm all for that. You know, I'm all for that. But I can't raise. You couldn't. What happened with Telepan is I had to raise prices over and over. So instead of becoming that neighborhood regular place to go to, it became that neighborhood regular special occasion place. Maybe celebrate your 50th anniversary or your 50th birthday, but your 43rd birthday and your 52nd anniversary.
Not so much.
And that was the problem is that, you know, between taxes and payroll and rent and
food costs,
and everything. I mean, they made it so it just became really hard. And like, you know, we get asked to do so many charity events. I mean, listen, I felt that the banks needed to be saved in order, or like we would have just collapsed and been, you know, just underwater if we didn't. But We need to save these small businesses. You live on the Upper West. Walk around. Walk down Broadway. I walk between 86th and Fairway, and it's like there's each side of Broadway. It's a ghost town.
It's
becoming a ghost town. And I'm not saying the landlords shouldn't make any money, but we got to have some relief somewhere. And I don't know where that relief is, whether it's like you get payroll credits or something like that, or you get – you're hiring locally or there's got to be a way that, small businesses have to survive. And, restaurants are getting blood from a stone. So when
margins are already small at a successful restaurant like Telepan. And, it becomes a matter of survival with dignity, right?
Yes.
You don't want to stiff people or have people wait, farmers, oh, can I pay you in a month? Because that happens all the time.
Well, there became a point where it's like, all right, do I take a check or do I pay my fish guy? Or do I pay, who do I pay or can I take a check or, things like that. You're at a point where I don't want to work for free. I'm valuable. I can make a lot of money. So why am I going to do this? I mean, I did it. I wanted to make it to 10 years stubbornly and admittedly stubbornly. And just because I thought, we could hopefully get a re-review that brings attention back to the restaurant and just help. We had a little less than four years left on our lease. I wanted to see what can happen there. And I didn't see it happening. I didn't see Wells coming in and nothing was going. Yeah, I could see we weren't going in that direction. And that's when it was like, you know what? I'm going into another summer. Do I really want, we were writing, my wife and I and Jimmy were writing checks just to keep it afloat. And it was like, it's great having all these people.
I've been there, bro.
You know, and it's like, you know what? I got to stop the bleeding.
Yeah.
And that's when it was like, and the reason it felt so abrupt was internally, I think, I was feeling like this is inevitable. And I could sense the staff was so supportive in a way that they were like, they knew what I was going through. You know what I mean?
But the outside world, you kept it.
We'd have this one regular come in and she's like, how are you doing? It's not busy. And like, Myra, it's 5 o'clock. We're not busy. Don't be like, calm, but knowing that it wasn't great. And then I decided that it was like going into the end of April, beginning of May, I was like, Mother's Day is coming. I make a ton of money Mother's Day. I could pay the rent. I could pay the staff. I could get rid of my taxes. Those three things that put you in jail, I could get rid of them. And I didn't. And I just said to my wife and Jimmy, said, let's do it this day.
Yeah.
And they agreed. And then I told the staff. But, and everyone's trying. I gave the staff a week, right? But everyone's like, oh, what a scumbag. You only gave your staff a week. But the truth is, everybody had a job by the end of that week who wanted a job. And I knew that, listen, I had a lot of great people working there. There was nobody I wouldn't recommend to anyone in that restaurant to another. And everyone's starving for people. I mean, everybody picked up a job.
Yeah.
And even people who decided, you know what, I don't want to work. This one guy who's like, he didn't want to work until this point, literally till now, is now like he's looking at three great job offers.
Yeah.
So this
is not it's not just a New York problem. I've read about this in San Francisco.
Right. Yeah.
Now it's not true all over the country, but it's certainly true in many major cities.
There's a very famous chef who I know in another city who has multiple restaurants who I had a discussion about this with. This was the point I was going to make before, is that he suffers in certain restaurants, but he's able to move money to these other places to help them, the other ones that are doing well. So you may have a high-end restaurant like Telepan that's going to sort of either – the margin is going to be so slim.
But then you're going to have a beer and burger bar.
Exactly, where you're making some money that you might – and that's the idea. It's not like I wanted to become, Danny Meyer
or have a mogul.
I just wanted a few places. I want my kid to go to college. I want to – maybe take a nice vacation or two and have a place and a roof over my head and some food.
You're really asking for a lot, dude. I don't really see
But I love what I do and to be able to do that,
right.
And I think that's the thing that kept me with Telepan. I loved the idea of it and I loved the people who came in there and I loved going to work every day, And I continue that because I just love my job and I love what I do. So I'm lucky there.
It's interesting because what you said about the chef in the other city having other places, I guess that's why we see Mark Ladner, the chef at Del Posto, leaving after a long time to open Pasta Flyer, which is going to be a fast casual concept.
Right.
It's why Danny Meyer, he loves opening serious restaurants, but there's probably much more money to be made in Shake Shack than there is
in the Union Square
Cafe. And that's obvious. And so what's the answer? Is the answer that municipalities that are dealing with gentrification are going to have to take some proactive steps, whether it's rent abatements or
I don't know, because I don't like I had a when I was at Telepan and I spoke to this guy through I met through a friend who owned the building that owned the Emerald Inn, which was this Irish bar that was there for 70 years, three or four generations of family who owned it. And I met him and I was really upset that they were closing. And because we would go there after work and we got to know everybody in the bar, and some of the regular the bartender would come on his break to Telepan, have a margarita. You know, this kind of we were just is this these things that were just really wonderful about like community. And the guy who owned the building was just like, yeah, you know, I'm kicking him out because I could put a Kate Spade in there. But how can you fault him? Like, our world is based on how much money you can make. And success is rated by how much money you have in your pocket.
Not by what you're contributing to the community.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, there's how do you fault this guy who owns this building? And the reason he owns the building is so he can make some money. You know what I mean? So if he's, why am I going to keep... And then you think, like, all right, so you could get $40,000 a month from Kate Spade, and you get $20,000 a month to keep the Emerald in there. Do you really need that $120,000 extra a year to, you know, or whatever, $240,000? But, you know, you think, like, hey, that's $250,000 a year I could be bringing in. That's a lot of money. I mean, it's like, unless we go to a socialist environment, then no, this is what's going to happen.
So we may be moving towards a situation in many cities across America where there are very high-end occasion restaurants, and then there are fast casual restaurants and a lot of ramen joints and pizza places where you can keep your food costs low and which can be delicious. By the way, I just ate a gin ramen.
Yeah, it's great.
It was awesome.
Love it there.
You know, I love ramen. I love pizza, but it'll make for a very different kind of food culture.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my wife keeps telling me, she goes, you know what you really need to do, Bill? You need to open a casual restaurant where you make your chicken and your burger, and but you have your interesting fishes, and it's not so complicated, but it's kind of like not, you know, a lobster roll and a hamburger and a noodle, like a ramen place. But, you know, yeah, that sounds great. We all want... I want to do that. You know, when I think about a place, like when we're sitting around and it's Sunday and we're like, where do we go? What do we want to eat that day? Because that's always a question I start with on Sunday or Saturday night. What are we going to eat tomorrow? And we end up sort of cooking at home, because if it's like usually what we want to eat is what she was just talking about. So there's a simple thing, like a simple piece of fish with some, where do you get good vegetables? Like, where do you go get? Like any, like I just want like a piece of fish with some vegetables or a pork chop, a really well cooked pork chop with, you know, some greens or something like that for dinner. And there's, it's
no,
it's not that anymore.
No,
it's all
just
starch, or fried.
And true.
And yeah, I like that stuff too. But yeah, so we end up eating at home most of the time because that's what you end up getting, you know.
Right.
And so that's missing. That's missing.
And it is missing. It's missing. And I think it's increasingly missing all over America. There are some cities that are at a different point in the narrative arc that we're talking about, you know, where Portland or Portland, Maine, or Charleston, where, although if, probably if you talk to chef in Charleston, he might tell you the same thing. I mean, it's hard to say. I know people talk about this in New Orleans.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely getting to a point where and listen, so like the situation I'm now with the Lovanos Group and Oceana, they own several restaurants, and that's a good thing. And you know, for me, it's like maybe at some point if everything goes well for me at Oceana, I mean, maybe there is the shot to sort of do something that's kind of like that casual. Like I always think about coming back to the Upper West Side and doing something up here because the community was great. But even when I went to Tribeca, you know, we wanted to become part of the community. It wasn't, you know, again, it wasn't about, yes, you want to make money, but that's the only way It's kind of a catch-22. They like people want restaurants to be their kitchen, and I get that, right? And then they'll complain, you know, there's cost in it. It's hard to I'm not articulate this way about how to explain it, but you see there's always these, you know, like they want us to give them truffles, but they don't want to pay $45 a gram, you know, whatever it is. But you know what? They're costing me $2,000 a pound. And, you know, or, you know, you want that fresh noodle that I make. Yeah, but it costs me, you know, $15 an hour to keep that guy on. And then he works overtime. It's 22, whatever. And it's like, you know, how do you, you know.
They literally want their cake and they
exactly.
want to eat it too.
And you know. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think right now it's like, you know, get involved with some good people. Somewhere I thread where, you know, to people, restaurants were in a small area. Maybe it was the East Village, Lower East Side, where people were going to come together and sort of to help fray costs, like have one accountant and have one person sort of manage and do all this stuff. And it's a great idea. And that's like if you want to do it, it's like you got to have this cooperative happens.
That happens in every business. We talk about that in the website business.
Right, yeah.
You know, and then everyone, yeah, we should all have, you know, because we're all fighting the same battles.
Right.
And it's always a great idea in theory, but to try to do it is a whole other thing.
Yeah, I don't know what, you know, we need that central office.
Exactly. So let's talk about wellness in the schools, which is something you've been involved with
for a long
time.
Talk about bureaucracy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it is school bureaucracy. But, I mean, why did you get involved and what is it?
Well, Wellness in the Schools is an organization that brings culinary school graduates into the cafeteria to cook healthy lunches with the Department of Education in New York and the school workers there. We also bring coaches into the recess yard to get the least active kid active and prevent playground bullying. And so the idea is that you have a healthy lunch and an active recess. The kids are awake and energized for the second half of the day and they could do better, you know. It was founded in 2005 by a few women, notably Nancy Easton, who's now the executive director. And Nancy saw kids. She was working at Lower East Side School. They would bring in big bags of orange chippies and with an orange soda, and they couldn't walk a flight of stairs. So she was like, "How can we get?" You know, she was a marathon runner, and she ran track at college, and you know, continue to do that and ate well. And she, you know, knew there was a connection between what the kids were eating and drinking and the obesity level. And the obesity levels were high at the time and still are. And so she decided that through food, you know, we can sort of change the way the kids, you know, are eating and get them healthier. So around 2008, they were in three schools at the time, one which was my daughter's school, PS 87 on West 78th Street. So I went to a parent-teacher conference with my wife, and Nancy and a bunch of the moms were handing out sandwiches that they wanted to put on the cafeteria worker. They had worked with the school food manager at the school to get these sandwiches on. I tasted them. They were, you know, it was like a Asian tofu thingy and a chicken thing, and it was delicious, you know. And I was like, "This is great. How can I help?" I said. And the idea was that since I was a chef, I could, you know, maybe take what they're doing and help them along. And went to a few meetings. And then at that point, going to meetings and talking with the school food administration and the schools and see what was being put out of play, I was like, I think I could do a little more than this. I can actually go in there and make that salad bar better and with my skills and go in there and cook from scratch. And so I went in and developed a vegetarian chili through recipes they have, because they had this giant, thick recipe book, but they weren't using it basically at the time. Do the sandwiches and present them a day and then do an enhanced salad bar. And so we kicked those 3 days off at my daughter's school and then went to the other two schools. It was a big success. And the following year, I mean, I just kind of went with it. It was like one of these things that you don't think about it. You just sort of did
it. So now how many schools are you involved
with? Right now we're in over 100 nationwide. We're in 87 in New York City. We're at several in Trenton and Camden. We're in four down in South Florida, in Fort Lauderdale, Miami. We're talking to Boston. We have.
So these are really at-risk kids.
Yeah. A lot of the schools, you know, it started in the low poverty schools like the Upper West Side. And now we work with a lot of high poverty schools. And we go in there with a cook who's in the cafeteria worker. The first year, it's a 3-year program. So the first year we're there every day, the second year twice a week, the third year once a week. We do cooking classes now. We call WITS Labs, where four times a year we do these cooking classes of food that they're getting in the cafeteria. We use that as a marketing tool. Kids love to cook. They get excited about it. And then things they wouldn't try before, now that they cooked it, they'll try it. And then they see that they like it, and then they'll eat it instead of eating the peanut butter and jelly sandwich or bringing a bag of chips to school. And the great other thing is the fitness part is just, you know, knowing how important, you know, getting kids to run around and be active. And people think like, oh, they always say, I'm too tired to exercise. Well, if you exercised, you wouldn't be so tired. And that's, I believe, is a fact. I use that. I try to, you know, I kind of walk the walk in this thing. I eat well, I think, and I
do. You used to be much heavier.
I used to be
20 pounds heavier.
Yeah. So I would go fluctuate back and forth. But, you know, I always feel that, like, you know, you have to be active. And I've always been active for you know, basically since I graduated CIA. And I think it's important. And people always look at it as hard work. Well, you know, it kind of is hard work. But if you look at it in a way, you feel so much better afterwards. I feel so much energized. Think about my work. I mean, it's a 12-hour day on my feet. And so, and I got to go and think. And there's a lot of bending and stuff.
Yeah.
And so you have to be flexible. You have to be strong. You have to, you know, you have to be alive and energized. And so that's the thing with the school. So we look at it as a way for not only just to in the school, but also to get people, you know, take it home and think about it and give kids the idea that they have to think this way for the rest of their lives.
Right. So, I mean, this has the potential of really mushrooming into something that could be taking place in schools all over the country.
Everywhere. Yeah. No, and that's the idea. I mean, the idea is, and what's great about the Department of Education, who runs the school food in New York City, is that they're seeing that, and we've seen their changes in their attitude towards it and the food. We call it the alternative menu, which takes away a lot of the fries, chicken fingers, and yada yada, the things that we think deem unhealthy, and we see that on their regular menus, they're coming close to the alternative. So we're looking for the alternative menu to be the regular menu.
Right.
And
yeah.
That's kind of what our goal is. So.
That's awesome. So now that you're the chef at Oceano, which is a very big Midtown New York seafood centric restaurant, is it hard to make the transition, or is it just so great to have the pressure off?
Well, there's different pressures now. I think, you know, I have a certain pressure to sort of perform, you know, because they brought me in to sort of help them take Oceana to, keep it going. It's 25 years old this year, and they hope to go for another 25 plus years. And I'd love to be a part of that. The Lovanos family and Paul McLaughlin, who run it, are wonderful people to work with and have given me a lot of breathing room. So I just hope that, you know, so there's that pressure. So, yes, I mean, the thing that stinks is that now when I have a petty cash slip and if I don't have the proper receipt, the central office is writing to me going, you don't have the right receipt. And I'm like, what, are you kidding me? So I ran my petty cash a little differently than they did. But obviously they've been in business for 25 years, so they're doing something right. So.
I'm familiar with this with the people who just bought Sirius Seats.
Yeah, so
I understand. So it's time for the All You Can Answer Special Sauce Buffet. These are when I ask you questions that will make you feel uncomfortable, just mildly. But and you can take your time answering them. But so who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Could be anybody living or dead, artists, poets, cooks, television stars. Website owners, could be anything.
Ed Levine.
No.
I don't know. I've been asked this question a bunch of times. And there's such – there's great people like Martin Luther King and Abraham Lincoln who you'd like to sort of hang out with and sort of see what's going on in their head. I would also love Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft to be there because I think they're probably – that could be kind of wild. To people like Will Ferrell, who I think would be funny, and you know, a guy like Tom York, the leader of Radiohead, I think.
Wait,
would be
that's
kinda...
it. That is such an awesome dinner,
right? Yeah,
you know, I would just
you got thinkers, you got comedians, and they're all very smart people. So
yeah, I like
it
that.
It'd be a lot of fun. So.
I like that. And what are you eating?
It'll be hard. Tom York's a vegetarian, but we'll have lots of vegetables. I always just like to sort of. When I think about my last meal, I want it to be things that I really like, and pork is one of those things. So I'd like a big roasted pork shoulder with crispy skin and just lots of vegetables depending on what time of year it is. to be there, whether they're grilled or roasted or sautéed with mm-hmm. lots of garlic and good potatoes and lots of great wine. I think wine is a great thing to have at a last meal.
I like that.
And tequila shots at the end.
Okay. Salt? No salt.
Salt?
On the tequila shots.
No salt. On
no
the
salt.
Tequila, no.
Okay. All right. Just checking.
No, I'm straight. No lime, no bit.
Okay.
No.
So what are your guilty pleasures? I feel guilty asking you this, being that we just talked about wellness in the schools. Do you have, guilty pleasures?
Oh, yeah, no. Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, man. You put them in front of me, I can't stop. They are, the best. And the thing about it that makes them not so bad is that they're one of the few candies that don't have partially hydrogenated oils in them.
Oh, my God.
So it's kind of natural. I'm showing quotes.
I like this. You've just given me an excuse to eat Reese's Peanut
there you
Butter
go,
Cups
there
every
you go,
day.
There you go.
And now they have dark chocolate ones.
I know, but you can't go dark.
Oh, right.
I'm sorry.
So what do you make when there's nothing in the house to eat? Using just basic pantry items, what will you always have that you can figure out what you can put together?
What I really love is we always have bread in the house, and we like Amy's sourdough bowl. We buy that Fairway every week,
right.
And we have that in the house. And I love a cheddar pickle mustard sandwich on her bread.
On her bread,
yeah.
Not toasted.
I mean, I'll make that into a grilled cheese,
right.
Which we'll take it to another level.
I see.
But if I come home from work at night and I'm kind of hungry, which is crazy because I work in a restaurant, but it does happen. We don't eat sometimes in a restaurant, and I like that a lot. Yeah.
So who's the one person, and it could be one of the people that's at your Last Supper, that you just have always thought, wow, I'd love to break bread with that person and just pick their brain and figure out what they have to say about the world?
Well, I don't know if it's about the world. I mean, there's a couple people is, Alan Chappelle is somebody who, in terms of just his mind and thinking about food, I got to work with him for 6 months, but when you work for somebody, you don't really get to know them as
right.
a
chef. So you don't have intimate conversations.
So it would have been wonderful to sort of really sit down with him one day and have a meal with him and just sort of shoot the breeze in terms of that.
So what would be happening on Bill Telepan Day? If there was a Bill Telepan Day in New York, I want to know, what would people do on Bill Telepan Day?
We would there'd be a margarita table. We would have loud music, some dancing, and just kind of having a good time and having, it'd all be about happy,
Joy.
Joy.
I
hope it would be about joy.
I like that. Well, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Bill Telepan. Come and eat Bill's food at Oceana in New York's Midtown. And if you do, eat at the chef's table in the kitchen and have that squid ink pasta, which was just so insanely good.
Thanks. Awesome.
And the next time you think about going to eat wherever you live, support your independent neighborhood chef-driven restaurants,
exactly.
Right? We need them more now than ever. So long, Sirius Eaters. We'll see you next time.